Wisconsin, a critical battleground state.
The battleground state of Wisconsin.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session.
So let's talk about Wisconsin.
This is Swing State of the Union, a podcast all about Wisconsin and why it's so important to U.S. politics. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Sam Woods. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll dig into the influence of money in Supreme Court elections and how justices are allowed to set their own ethical standards. But we'll start with the story of how a case of child lead paint poisoning led to the most expensive state court race in U.S. history.
Peter Earl is a semi-retired lawyer who has practiced in Milwaukee for most of his career. He's argued cases all over the country, in state courts and federal courts. But to this day, he remembers when a child named Stephen Thomas came into his office about 25 years ago.
Stephen was a little boy when he came into my office. He had been very severely poisoned by lead, to the point that he had to undergo multiple hospitalizations for a process that's called chelation, where they inject chemicals into his body, and those chemicals will bind with the lead in his blood, and then it gets excreted out of the body to bring the level down.
Stephen had been poisoned by lead paint in his home. Children are most often exposed to lead paint by ingesting it when it chips or by breathing in lead-contaminated dust. In 2005, his case came before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The case, called Thomas v. Mallett, didn't focus on whether Stephen had been poisoned, but about who could be held liable.
In a typical liability case, where one party is suing another party for damages, the burden of proof would have been on Stephen's lawyers to prove which paint manufacturer made the paint that poisoned Stephen and hold only that company responsible for damages. But it was impossible to prove exactly which company the paint came from. Several companies knowingly sold lead paint in the early to mid-1900s, even after it had been shown to cause developmental issues, especially in children.
As Sherwin-Williams said, literally, in January of the year 1900, in their internal magazine, lead is, quote, a deadly cumulative poison. Okay? They knew it in 1900, and they knew that the dust would blow around the house because that's what they talked about in that article. Okay, but they marketed it, and they sold it.
Earl argued the burden of proof should be on companies to prove their innocence, rather than on Stephen's side to prove their guilt.
You have no idea who put the paint on the wall. You know, you have no receipts from the purchase of the paint. You have a wall with lead paint. You know, and it's impossible to identify the manufacturer. Okay, so the Thomas case came into this because we said all of the paint manufacturers should be liable because we can't figure out who amongst them was the one that poisoned the individual child, in this case, Stephen Thomas.
This argument is called risk contribution theory. It reversed traditional liability logic. The Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed with the argument that the paint manufacturers should be held collectively responsible, marking a major shift in precedent that left the manufacturers open to future lawsuits and future payouts. Earl remembers the nationwide reaction from the business community about this decision.
All of the big business groups in the country, the Wall Street Journal, went ballistic. They said that the Wisconsin Supreme Court went off the deep end. This was the beginning of the end for free enterprise, that manufacturers shouldn't have to be the insurers of each other's products. They painted a doomsday scenario for Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's business community organized, launching a campaign to reverse the decision. It started by ousting Justice Lewis Butler, who wrote the Thomas decision.
In 2008, Justice Butler was running to retain his seat on the bench. He was appointed 4 years earlier, was well-respected by his colleagues, and as an incumbent, was favored to win his election. An incumbent Supreme Court justice had not lost an election in over 40 years. His challenger was Michael Gableman. Though today, Gableman is better known for his role in attempting to overturn Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election results, at the time, he was a circuit court judge with little experience compared to Butler. but he had the backing of Wisconsin's business lobby, in particular, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and access to the lobby's war chest.
Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, or WMC, is an organization representing thousands of Wisconsin businesses, from foundries to security consultants. Think of it like a statewide chamber of commerce that lobbies on behalf of Wisconsin's business community. The group has helped fund campaigns for governors and state legislators, typically backing Republicans. Jay Heck is the executive director at Common Cause Wisconsin, a government accountability organization focused on removing big money from politics. He remembers the 2008 election as decidedly different in tone from previous Wisconsin Supreme Court elections.
2008 was a particularly odious, vicious campaign. Gableman was aided by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, by Wisconsin Club for Growth. Substantial outside money poured in to help him. And then he also was the recipient of large campaign contributions. And he was infamous for running, and this was the Gableman campaign, that ran a very vicious racial ad against Butler.
The racial ad Heck is describing is one we discussed in episode 2. It featured a photo of Butler, Wisconsin's first and only Black Supreme Court justice, set next to a photo of another Black man who had been Butler's client when he was a lawyer.
Louis Butler worked to put criminals on the street, like Reuben Lee Mitchell, who raped an 11-year-old
girl. The ad misled viewers about Butler's role in getting Mitchell, the man featured in the ad, released. It was immediately labeled a Willie Horton-style ad, a reference to a notoriously racist ad in the 1988 presidential campaign.
But the campaign funded by the business lobby was successful. Gableman won the election. An ethics charge was filed against him for running misleading ads, which eventually worked its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Since Gableman was at the center of the case, he recused himself, and the remaining justices split their decision 3-3. With no clear verdict, Gableman didn't face consequences. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce spent about $2 million on the race, nearly a third of the total money spent by or on behalf of both candidates. We asked WMC for an interview about the 2008 race and how the Wisconsin Supreme Court fits into its mission to support Wisconsin businesses. A spokesperson declined the interview.
According to Barry Burden, director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, WMC spending and Gableman's 2008 campaign set the tone for future Supreme Court races.
Looking back, it looks like kind of a harbinger of things that were to come later. The clearer connections of the candidates to the parties, the kind of tough campaign ads that are really aggressive and maybe distortive of their opponents' records. There were some cases, I think, that Butler had been involved in that Gableman had raised to the surface. It was just something that was not done so much in the past. You know, a lot of these elections in the past were not even contested. It was simply one candidate who was already on the court or was perceived as the front runner allowed to go.
Big spending in Supreme Court races was just getting started, and 2011 would mark both the end of risk contribution theory as precedent and the beginning of a fundraising arms race in judicial elections.
To kickstart our plan to create 250,000 jobs, I will call a special session of the state legislature starting today. We will present a bold set of reforms aimed at helping businesses create jobs.
In his first speech as governor in 2011, Republican Scott Walker called on the legislature to help Wisconsin businesses. The state was facing a fiscal crisis, and Walker said reforms were needed to help kickstart Wisconsin's economy. But for Peter Earle, the lawyer who fought to hold lead paint manufacturers accountable, these reforms made it clear that Walker and his allies in the business lobby were coming for his legal wins.
The first act of the legislature after Scott Walker took over was Act One, which was the internal reorganization of the legislature, committee assignments, chairs, and that kind of stuff, right? Act Two was the abrogation of the Thomas decision, the undoing of the Thomas decision. They call it tort reform.
Act Two was a bill that, among other things, changed state law so people could no longer sue on the grounds of risk contribution. Though this was a devastating blow to Earle and Wisconsin families suing for lead liability. Weeks later, it was overshadowed by a more controversial proposal, Act 10.
Sure.
As we explained in our last episode, that Republican author bill stripped public sector unions of most collective bargaining rights and deeply divided Wisconsinites.
Meanwhile, an election was coming up for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Conservative-backed incumbent Justice David Prosser was up for re-election, running against liberal-backed Judge Joanne Kloppenburg. Though initially, this appeared to be another quiet, low-turnout judicial election, Act 10 had altered Wisconsin's political landscape, including its Supreme Court races. Barry Burden explains.
So the Supreme Court race became something of a proxy for that conflict. And Kloppenburg, who I think early on did not look like she had much chance at defeating a sitting incumbent, got elevated, I think, as kind of a hero of that anti-Act 10 movement. And Prosser, who's a former Republican legislative leader, he'd been a speaker in the assembly, connected to Scott Walker in some ways, became a proxy for that side. And so turnout in that election really spiked, even though there was not a lot of money spent on the election by today's standards. The fact that it was a stand-in for other things made it more partisan. And then it ended up being extremely close. It went to a statewide recount of all the ballots across the state, eventually declaring Prosser the narrow winner.
During this election, Wisconsin was testing a new strategy to make Supreme Court races more fair and less partisan.
Both candidates agreed to take money from public financing. This is money provided by taxpayers that is distributed to candidates equally, with rules for how it can be spent. As Jay Heck of Common Cause Wisconsin explains, it was a bipartisan attempt to rein in spending in judicial elections before it got out of hand.
After the terrible experience in 2008, after those elections, Republicans and Democrats got together and said, well, at the very least, we should make sure that this money doesn't begin infecting the Wisconsin Supreme Court anymore. And so they passed 100% public financing. And so in 2011, neither David Prosser, who won by a slim margin, or his opponent, Joanne Kloppenburg, accepted any private money. They each received $400,000 in public funding. And that was good because the amounts of money were roughly equal. And Prosser won the election, but it wasn't because, you know, one side spent, you know, $20 million for him and only $10 million for the other side.
As Heck alludes to, this experiment was short-lived. A year before the 2011 election, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United v. FEC that corporations and other groups could spend unlimited amounts of money in elections. Essentially, the court found that money was the equivalent of free speech.
This decision undercut the effectiveness of public financing for campaigns in Wisconsin because it allowed political candidates to raise money that far exceeded what public dollars could offer without the rules that came with taking public money. As J.R. Ross of WisPolitics explains, this led to the end of public money for Supreme Court campaigns in Wisconsin.
When you talk about the kind of money that comes into a race when it's a nationalized race, when there's that much attention, the public money couldn't keep up with it.
With money now flowing into Supreme Court races uninhibited, a group of Wisconsin judges called for a change.
In 2017, 54 retired Wisconsin judges petitioned the Wisconsin Supreme Court to require judges and justices to recuse themselves from matters involving anyone who financially supported their campaigns. In other words, if I was a justice and Sam gave me $1 million for my campaign, I wouldn't be able to rule on a case that might benefit Sam. Heck says this was an effort to bring Wisconsin more in line with guidelines in other states regarding recusal. That's the act of removing oneself from a case if one cannot be impartial.
Most states and in most places, it's required by law. It's not even a judgment call on the part of the justice or the judge. It's just you cannot participate if you were the recipient of a campaign contribution or the beneficiary of an expenditure equal to that amount.
In a 5-2 ruling, the Wisconsin Supreme Court rejected this petition. In explaining their opposition, conservative-backed justices Annette Ziegler, Michael Gableman, and Daniel Kelly each emphasized that they trusted individual justices to decide for themselves when recusal was necessary. For Heck, the problem is the perception that justices are beholden to campaign donors.
You know, anybody who looks at a campaign of a justice for the Supreme Court and sees that they've received an enormous amount of money from a group And that group then somehow finds its way, whether it's WMC or some Democratic Party group, and they come before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and the justice decides for themselves, well, no, I can be fair and unbiased, and I can listen to this case. Well, I don't think a lot of people believe that.
We'll return to this petition and the ongoing debate over ethics rules for Wisconsin Supreme Court justices later in the episode. But in 2023, these issues of money and judicial ethics would come to a head, as Wisconsin would set the record for the most expensive state court race in U.S. history.
As liberal-backed Judge Janet Protasiewicz faced off against conservative-backed former Justice Dan Kelly for a seat on Wisconsin Supreme Court, the partisan lines were clear. Protasiewicz expressed her support for Democratic Party priorities, like reproductive rights and fair voting maps. Kelly campaigned on Republican priorities, like Second Amendment protection. Their donors reflected those priorities. Kelly received donations from typical conservative donors, like the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. He tried to distance himself from partisan interests, saying he would reject party money. But he ultimately accepted $800,000 from the Republican Party. In a throwback to 2008, Kelly's campaign used some of this money on a shot-for-shot remake of the original 1988 Willie Horton ad.
Despite facing 60 years in prison, Judge Janet refused to give Bounds any prison time at all.
Protasiewicz received support from typical liberal donors and more readily accepted political party support. The Democratic Party contributed about $9 million to her campaign, according to Open Secrets. This was a major jump in direct party donations to a Supreme Court candidate. But political parties have been donating to Supreme Court candidates since at least 2018, when Republicans gave nearly $500,000 in donations and in-kind contributions to conservative-backed candidate Michael Scrinoch, who lost. Protasiewicz won the 2023 election handily. Overall, around $50 million was spent on the race, mostly on advertising. This was more than three times the previous national record for money spent on a state Supreme Court race.
J.R. Ross, editor at WisPolitics, explains how nationwide political events, including the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade in its 2022 Dobbs decision, came together to create record spending in this race.
This was a full-blown political campaign involving national groups because it was right after the first judicial campaign, right after Dobbs. We had the 1849 law in the books that had only been challenged yet about abortion. It all came together in this perfect storm of that plus redistricting. There was a kind of a quiet push, not really quiet sometimes, but hey, if they flip the court, they could take a run, challenge these maps that the court had approved just that prior spring and argued that the lines are not appropriate. Lo and behold, that came past. So you add all those things together, that was a ton of money was spent in that race. Nothing comes close to what was spent in 2023. That was the first time that we saw a Supreme Court race in Wisconsin nationalized in that way that had so many groups from outside the state getting involved in what was going on.
After Protasiewicz won the election, Kelly and Republicans criticized her for making her positions on issues like abortion and gerrymandering known, given that she was likely to rule on those issues while on the Supreme Court. In his concession speech, Kelly said this.
I wish that in a circumstance like this, I would be able to concede to a worthy opponent. But I do not have a worthy opponent to which I can concede.
But judicial candidates are free to talk about their views on political issues, as laid out in the U.S. Supreme Court's 2002 decision in Republican Party of Minnesota v. White. As J.R. Ross explains, judicial candidates are allowed to receive unlimited amounts in campaign donations from political parties, in part due to rules written by Republican lawmakers in 2015.
Republicans wrote the law, created this provision of unlimited contributions and transfers. At the time, they had basically a good winning streak in Wisconsin. Governor Walker was still in office. They thought, hey, this is going to benefit us. And then the perfect storm of what a swing state we are created this environment for the Democrats to just raise more money from big donors nationally.
So openly campaigning on political issues is legal, and taking unlimited money from political parties is also legal. But Is it ethical? And how does this square with our ideas of how the judicial branch is supposed to work?
After a short break, we'll speak with former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske about judicial ethics and norms, campaign donations, and recusal requirements.
If you're enjoying WUWM's Swing State of the Union, please share it with a friend. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske was one of the people who signed a 2017 petition calling for clear recusal rules and limitations on campaign contributions in Wisconsin Supreme Court elections. Gieske was a member of the court from 1993 through 1998 when she resigned. She joins us to discuss her concerns about the influence of money on court campaigns and the ethical questions these funds raise. She begins by explaining the connection between campaign finance and partisan polarization.
The way I like to explain all this is I think you have to back up a little bit. And when I talk to the public, I'll say, you want to know why courts are important? Look at these three cases, because these three U.S. Supreme Court cases have deeply influenced what's happened. The first was Citizens United, which is a case that people know a lot about, and money is speech and corporations are people, and it's clear how I feel about that case. And then another case that came along was the Republican Party versus White, I think the name was, out of Minnesota. And it used to be, we all had a sense that ethically, we could not say to people, this is how I'm going to vote on a case. Or you didn't even want to infer that this is how you're going to vote on a case. Well, this case involved the state of Minnesota that had ethical prohibitions for judicial candidates to talk about where they are on cases or on issues that might come before the court. The United States Supreme Court, and I know that Justice Alito, I don't know if he wrote the opinion, but he certainly wrote in the opinion, that I think the public ought to know where people are on the court. You know, and they held that it's a First Amendment right of candidates to talk about where they are on the court. The reason that case becomes important is for people like me who were not politically involved, who didn't take public stance on lots of issues, there was nothing I was carrying into my race that would say, oh, she's going to do this or she's going to do that. You know, what happens when candidates start doing that is people think it's just like their legislator coming in and saying, this is how I'm going to vote if that issue comes before the legislature. You got my vote. The last case that came up is a case that our court, unfortunately, has pretty well ignored. It was Caperton. And in that case, a justice out of West Virginia had been running. He took a $3 million contribution from a company, and then he was elected, and he sat on a case involving that company that had lost a $50 million case, and he ruled for the company. And that went to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finally said, well, when it's this much and it's so direct, this goes to due process. You know, this has gone too far. Our court, in looking at campaign contributions, has not applied Caperton to anything. And we still have a rule that each judge makes their own decision based on the rules. And the rules say a campaign contributions are not enough to get off a case. So all those things were happening simultaneously when you ask how we got there. But those kinds of things were happening in part because of the pressures of certain groups in our community. And what the court should have done and would have historically done is appointed a blue ribbon panel of ethics experts from around the country to take a look at what was happening and make recommendations to the court. Now, a few years later, a group of us, 50-some judges, signed a petition before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, again asking for a rule about recusal and campaign contributions. The court again shut down that petition, did nothing, did not appoint a blue ribbon panel, and said, we're sticking with what we have. Now we have a situation where we have judges receiving millions and millions of dollars from special interests. you know, people from all over the country. I mean, it's not even people from Wisconsin.
As you mentioned, you signed a petition in 2017 asking for stricter recusal rules. It seems like not much has happened since then. Do you see any desire from the Supreme Court to enact stricter rules?
I do think there are people on that court, and frankly, even judicial candidates who run, who'd be interested in doing that. The problem we have is now we have justices and judges who've received millions of dollars from special interest groups. And so what are they going to do when a case comes in front of them if they have a rule that says if you got over $10,000, you can't sit on the case? You know, it's a dilemma for them. And I don't know what the answer is. I've been sort of battling in that in my head. I think they almost have to adopt a rule and say it's not retroactive. Starting now, if you receive a campaign contribution in excess, whatever the number is, you cannot sit on the case.
I think it is fair to be skeptical that a justice can be impartial on a case that might benefit someone who contributed to that justice's campaign. And yet we have a system where justices are allowed to decide for themselves whether they can be impartial. Is this because the current system benefits justices and the special interest groups and political parties that donate to their campaigns? Or is there something more going on behind the scenes that we can't see?
We can't change what the U.S. Supreme Court has done unless you do a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But short of that, all we can do is make certain behavior by judges unethical. And that's where the concentration is on this issue. In theory, if I have somebody I really like being elected to the court, and I have a lot of cases in front of that court, and I know if I give more than X amount of dollars to that judge won't be able to sit on the case, I'm not going to give that money. I'd rather that judge hear my case than throw them off. You know, I remember when I was on the, running for election, I did receive like a $2,500 check from a lawyer who had a case in front of the court, and I saw it. I mean, I looked at all those numbers, and I sent it back to him at the time. You know, I don't want to be receiving any money from anybody who has anything in front of the court. But there's another argument, and I will tell you what Justice Kelly would argue about why you can't do this. And his argument, and it has some merit, is that you're worried about influence of money. But how does money that's been used against you influence you in reaching a decision? So if I've had, well, let's say, the Democratic Party and pro-choice people giving me millions and millions of dollars and attacking me because I'm in the other part of the race and attacking me and attacking my family and putting out lies as I see it, there's a risk that I'm never going to rule anything for them because what they did to me during my race.
So we've seen Wisconsin Supreme Court campaigns get more expensive gradually over about 20 years and then exploding in 2023. How do you think this affects the legitimacy of the court in the eyes of voters?
I think it has a huge negative impact on people's sense that the court is truly impartial and fair. And I will blame the media in part. They never talk about any of these justices without liberal or conservative in front of their names. And I understand why they do that, but it doesn't help any because people think that's how the votes are. I think people don't like all the money, are worried about the money, and they're worried about what the money buys. People get so sick of those ads that are pounding on those judges. I mean, it's, you know, the harm they do to those judges and their families. I know a lot of lawyers and judges who would have made excellent Supreme Court judges that will not go anywhere near running for office because of what happens in those races. So that's another ripple effect, is we lose really, really good candidates and judges and lawyers who might make excellent justices who are not going to run. And I, you know, in this atmosphere, I would have had a hard time applying for a position, because I think it's almost impossible to run right now if you're going to just say, I'm not going to talk about the cases and I'm going to be fair and impartial, and you've got all this money being poured into the other side. I think you're not going to have a chance. But it does go to the heart of the fairness and impartiality. And if people don't have faith in the decisions, we've lost our system, because that's what the courts have, is people having faith in that third branch of government to be independent. And if we're not independent, then we are like a lot of other countries where the other branches of the government really control what happens.
Jeanine Geske is a former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice who left the court in 1998.
When thinking about Supreme Court ethics, Sam and I kept coming back to a chicken and egg question. Does a Supreme Court justice change their behavior on the bench due to the money they get in campaign donations, or does the money find the candidate that already aligns with their priorities? For Barry Burden, director of the Elections Research Center, there's evidence for both.
You know, the answer is it's both the chicken and egg. Both things are happening. The money is following candidates who represent the views of the people who are giving the money. So they're finding people to support whose values or agendas or records line up with their interests. But I think there's also good evidence that once they're on the court, judges do respond to the financial interests that got them there. There's a book forthcoming by law professor Michael Kang and his co-author that has some really good evidence from interviews with justices and statistical analysis showing that Supreme Court justices who were elected tend to be more favorable to parties who gave them money and then end up having a case that they have an interest in that shows up before the court. So, you know, it's not always one-to-one. There are lots of other things going on in cases. Sometimes the facts or the precedent is so overwhelming that nobody's personal interest would matter very much. But there are definitely places where you can see the influence of that money.
And things seem to be accelerating in 2025. In this year's Supreme Court election, the partisan stakes are high and the national money is flowing. Both sides have received money from national interests, including from big donors like Trump-aligned billionaire Elon Musk, who has already contributed at least $12 million in support of the conservative-backed candidate. And this year, Wisconsin broke spending records again. According to WisPolitics, about $59 million was spent on the 2025 race before early voting even began.
Let's go back to the case from the beginning of this episode, which opened the doors to this big spending in Supreme Court elections. Even though Stephen Thomas won the initial Supreme Court case, the paint companies won in the long run. In his 2007 trial, Thomas wasn't able to prove it was lead paint dust that caused his injury, instead of lead in water or cigarette smoke or other health hazards. To this day, children in Milwaukee are being poisoned by lead paint in schools and in homes.
And that breaking news comes from Milwaukee Public Schools. Trowbridge School in Milwaukee temporarily closing starting Monday due to lead.
As the Supreme Court election was heating up in February, the Milwaukee Health Department began investigating Milwaukee Public Schools after students tested positive for lead. Multiple schools were temporarily closed to address unsafe levels of lead from paint. Despite all the money pouring into Supreme Court races, lead remains a danger to children in Milwaukee 20 years after the Thomas decision. On the next episode of Swing State of the Union, we focus on the 2025 election. We cover the issues candidates are campaigning on, the money fueling these campaigns, and what's at stake.
He started calling on the Wisconsin Manufacturers Commerce, the state's business lobby, Fair Courts America, and other groups to get involved in the race because he knew they had more money than he did. And days later, they jumped in.
Crawford v. Schimmel. Next time on Swing State of the Union, I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. Swing State of the Union is produced by WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, a part of the NPR network. Please subscribe to the Swing State of the Union podcast wherever you like to listen.